So welcome everyone to the December session of season number 18 of the Denver Community College Torah for Tycoons program. As always, thank you to the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we continue our 18th, that's our Chai season. Just one announcement tonight, I want to encourage all of you here to consider having a conversation with one of the Kol rabbis, that's me or other Kol rabbis, about the Kol's Live on Life and Legacy program, and that's organized and offered here in Denver through Rose Community Foundation, and that's helping the Kol and many other Denver organizations create future financial stability through planned giving such as wills, estate planning, and endowments. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our presenter this evening, and that is Howie Shapiro, or some say Shapiro. You'll let us know in a second which way is really the right way to do it, to pronounce it. And he is an intelligence analyst for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, better known as the FBI, which certainly caught my attention. And we're looking forward to a very interesting presentation tonight. So thank you very much for being here and for agreeing to present tonight. And please go ahead.
It is actually Shapiro. And my parents are online and they can attest to that. My grandfather was born in Philadelphia. They're all Shapiros and Levines and not Levines. So he had the good sense to move to Los Angeles back in the 30s. Dad, 30s? Anyway, and it stuck. And it was Shapiro, and it's still Shapiro. And the only one who is a Shapiro in my family is my wife. So that's the way that goes. That's fine. She knew what she was marrying. Anyway. Good evening, everyone. I'm Howie Shapiro. I'm an intelligence analyst for the FBI. I've been working there for about almost 6 years. I've done 5 years in counterterrorism, working primarily homegrown violent extremists and Shia threats. So like Iran, Hezbollah. And then, I did about 6 months covering the, violent crimes against children and human trafficking squad. And then I got out of that very luckily. And now I am the domain management coordinator for our field office. And what that's like a fancy title. It's not fancy. Basically what it means is I look at things that are changing, shifting, evolving within our area of responsibility that could impact multiple threats. So I get to work with all the other analysts and work on a specific product line that we have in intelligence products that is more of a warning and forecasting kind of product for our field office and other field offices and upper management, that kind of stuff. That's pretty much what I do. So what does it mean to be an analyst? So day to day, you're typically embedded on a squad and you can work any one of the different threats that the FBI covers. So we have analysts who work white collar crime. We have analysts who work cyber, counterintelligence, counterterrorism, and other crimes, violent crimes. So typically, while agents cover their particular cases, the analyst in the squad is worried about the overall threat. So we're looking for kind of forward-leaning assessments and judgments on what's happening, what's changing, what's shifting, where do our resources need to be applied, what kind of source base do we have, do we need a better one, should we go out and recruit some folks? So it's quite a very interesting field. I didn't really know what I was going to get myself into when I did this, and I'm really happy I did it. So aside from being an analyst, which is my normal main job, we have collateral duties at the FBI. And some of our people join the evidence response teams. That's like our CSI. So if there's a crime and the FBI needs to collect evidence or we do a search, we have whole teams of people that are dedicated to do just that. But that's their collateral duty. In other words, there's one guy in the office, that's his whole job. And everybody else takes time out of their normal job to do that. So my collateral duty is I'm a crisis negotiator. So basically we deploy with SWAT when they go hit a house. And our job is if the people inside don't want to come out, They shoot back. They refuse to come out. Our job is to talk them out. So I used to be a school psychologist and a teacher. I did that for about 10 years before joining the Bureau. Folks who know me from DOT, I was their teacher. I might have taught some of your kids. I don't know. Or people you're familiar with. So people usually ask me, like, that's such a crazy career change going from a teacher and school psychologist to working for the FBI. And I'm like, not really. I used to work with emotionally unstable juveniles who were potentially armed. And now I work with agents who are emotionally unstable juveniles who are definitely armed. So it's right in line with what I do. A little show and tell. So for SWAT, when we go out with SWAT, I'm don't worry, mom and dad. Those are my parents up there. I'm in the safest place you could possibly be. I'm in the Bearcat, which is basically like an armored personnel carrier. Usually, sometimes I'm not even on the scene, but when I'm on the scene, that's the vehicle I'm in. We do all of our negotiating over the phone. And most of the time, I would say 99.9% of the time, we don't have to negotiate, right? SWAT does a great job of getting people to come out. And they convince them with, you know, things like flashbangs and lots of people with lots and lots of guns. So I have a bulletproof vest right here. So I'll wear that. It's a soft vest. So this is good for stopping handgun rounds. We have the plate carrier, which is significantly heavier. So that's this here. And wrong way. Sorry. There's a ballistic plate in there. It's about this thick. It's for stopping rifle rounds, which probably won't, but we wear them anyway. There's a med pack on the side over here, which I have. Flashlight. So those are some of the tools. Those are some of the fun toys that I have. Most of the time, I'm using a computer. That's what I do. I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of writing. And I do a lot of briefing. And I do a lot of training. I just finished up a 3-day training that I had online, which I did from my basement, which is great because, believe it or not, it's a lot easier for me to focus when I'm at home than I am at work, because I'd have to, you know, find a place where no one's going to bother me. And it's just a lot easier doing it from the privacy of my own basement. So I did a 3-day course on, psychology and criminology in intel work. It was an interesting course. I enjoyed myself thoroughly. The COLAs asked me to do this a couple of times, and I'm like, gosh, I don't know what I would talk about. And when Rabbi Fleischer approached me this past time, I said, you know, when I was on the counterterrorism squad, some issues came up with regard to Shmirat Shabbat and Pikuach Nefesh. So keeping Shabbat and then balancing that out with protecting human life. And doctors have great liberties with what they can do on Shabbat in order to save human life. And I thought it might be interesting to talk about some of the parameters around what we can do in a law enforcement setting in terms of violating Shabbat. So, for example, when I was on the counterterrorism squad, I've had great supervisors. I probably had 4 supervisors since I started working at the Bureau. They kind of have cycled through. But each and every one of them understands Shabbat. I work a little bit extra on, during the week, during the winter time, and then leave a little early on Fridays. They're fine with that. I have leave for the holidays, no problem. The tricky issue was what happens if we think someone's going to happen, or we're concerned about something happening, or something does happen on Shabbat. How does that work out? And how do I, balance that out? When do I say, I can't do that, find someone else, versus no, I need to deal with that. So, practically speaking, I've had to keep my phone on a handful of occasions over the past 6 years. It usually happens about once a year. We have information or something that we're concerned that something might happen over the weekend. So I'll keep my phone on. Those were in a national security context back when I was doing counterterrorism. Other than that, it hasn't really been an issue, but I thought it would be interesting for us to explore some of those topics. And Rabbi Fleischer has prepared some sources that he'll be discussing kind of the parameters of Pikuach Nefesh, of saving a life on Shabbat. And I'll mute myself now. If there's any questions, you can feel free to throw them out at the end.
I think if you're okay with it, if there are any questions now for you at this point, we can pose for questions now.
Any questions about the FBI I can answer, or if, any details on what I do or and that kind of stuff. Anyone can feel free to unmute and go ahead and ask.
Did someone come to recruit you, or you applied for this job?
I applied. I went online and applied. It was something that I was always interested in doing. Back when I was a school psychologist, I did a lot of bully prevention programs. And there was a very interesting statistic that 75% of all school shootings were bully related. And I thought, oh my God, that's a crazy statistic. That's such an interesting nexus there. Cause I was always interested in the, law enforcement side of life. When I got my master's, I focused on, forensic psychology and, you know, after 10 years doing it, doing school psych, I shifted over, but it was something that, I wasn't recruited.
Thanks.
No problem. Any other questions before we jump into the sources with Rabbi Fleischer?
All right.
Okay, Rabbi Fleischer, the floor is yours.
Easy crowd tonight so far. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Howie, for that very interesting presentation. Just give me a moment as I just get my act together here. Can you see, is everyone able to see that screen of the sources? Did that come up?
Yep.
Okay.
We see it.
Okay. Very good. So what I'm going to try to do over here as Howie mentioned, in the context of doctors and things like that, I'm sorry, just give me one moment. In the context of doctors, there is quite a bit of literature in halachic sources, starting, as we will see, from the Torah itself, moving through the Talmud to later commentators and so on, about what is permitted on Shabbos, on Shabbat, what a doctor can or cannot do to save a life, and so on and so forth. You're not going to find a whole lot in traditional Talmudic literature about what a law enforcement officer, an FBI agent, and so on can do. But what we're going to try to do is see some of the sources that you can see on the source sheet already that I have up here. We're going to try to look at some of the sources that come up in the context of medicine and try to apply those ideas to where they can be relevant for law enforcement. As is often the case in Torah for Tycoons classes, I don't know that we'll walk away with a definitive ruling on complex cases. We'll try to look at the parameters and at some of the ideas that come up when a halachic authority is consulted, what that halachic authority would be taking into account when being consulted and what he would be thinking about. But if you're going to start asking about a very specific case and so on, I don't know that I'm prepared to give any sort of real practical ruling. Okay, so here we go. Right off the bat, and the first few sources are some that a lot of you may be familiar with, or at least the ideas therein. The Talmud in Yuma, which is the tractate that deals with Yom Kippur, has an extensive discussion about a person whose life is in danger may not fast on Yom Kippur if fasting will put their life in danger and could cost them their life. And the Talmud has an extensive discussion over there. What is the source for that idea? Where do you have that? And there are a whole bunch of different scriptural sources that different Talmudic sages advance. And I just quoted one of them, which I think is, kind of puts it very, very clearly and gets very straight to the point. And that is, the verse says, we say this, a lot of people say this by Kiddush on Shabbos morning, and the Bnei Yisrael and the Jewish people shall observe the Shabbos. We say that by Kiddush, Vishamru, Bnei Yisrael es HaShabbos. The Torah says the Talmud, the Torah says to desecrate one Shabbos so that he can observe many Shabbos. Okay, and that's again based on the laws of biblical exegesis that we can expound and infer from that verse. The Jewish people shall observe the Shabbos is understood to be alluding to an idea that there's a bigger picture of Shabbos of observing Shabbos, that if a person will have the opportunity to observe future Shabbosos, so then one Shabbos can be desecrated to enable a person to observe many in the future by saving that individual's life. Okay, parenthetically, not our discussion tonight, but someone will apply this idea to Jewish outreach as well. Can you engage in Jewish outreach and perhaps have a person who is not yet observant of Shabbat, of Shabbos, can you invite them, let's say, over for a meal, even though they may do something to come to your house that they should not be doing on Shabbos? Again, not judging anyone, just due to ignorance or something like that, in the hope that perhaps they will become more observant. So there are some who want to invoke this as perhaps a source to allow that. That's a whole subject unto itself, but just an interesting tangential conversation that comes up in that context. But for our purposes, the Talmud's conclusion is that one is not just allowed to, but even obligated to desecrate one Shabbos so that he can observe many Shabbos. There are other sources as well in the Talmud, which I'm not getting into over here. Okay, now, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, so it says that it was taught, the one who acts with alacrity is praised. This is talking about when a life is in danger and the Shabbos needs to be desecrated. The one who acts with alacrity is praised. The one who is asked is disgraceful, meaning if a halachic authority is asked, am I allowed to desecrate the Shabbos to save a life? It is considered a disgrace for that rabbi to be asked that question. Not that he's done anything wrong per se, but it's just like a very awkward, not pleasant situation that it's come to that. Okay. And the one who asks is a murderer. Okay. Now let's be clear. We're talking about a situation where a life is on the line at this moment. So just as an example, if God forbid someone is choking, and let's just say no one there is able to perform, the Heimlich maneuver or whatever it is to relieve the individual, and someone there says, let me go run next door and ask the rabbi if we're allowed to call an ambulance or medical personnel, that person, and instead of acting on the spot and calling immediately, that may well be akin to murder for waiting to do something. So again, very clear in the Talmud over here, the importance that if a life is on the line, if there's any possibility, okay, again, we'll see later, a real possibility right now of someone's life being in danger, you act first and ask questions later in terms of whether Shabbos should be desecrated. If there's a real possibility that someone's life is in danger, the Shabbos is desecrated and you figure it out afterwards. Okay. Source number three, also a well-known source. All sins in the Torah, except for idolatry, forbidden relationships, and murder, if they tell a person to transgress or be killed, we're talking about where person A, let's just say, points a gun at person B and says, eat that ham sandwich or I'm going to kill you. If he is in private, he may transgress and not be killed. Now, this is, again, a very broad discussion over in what situations is a person obligated to give up his life rather than commit a sin. Okay, but on a very basic level, assuming it's in private, it's not in a public setting, the three cardinal sins as they are known, and that is idolatry, forbidden sexual relationships, and murder, are the three cardinal sins one must give up one's life. Even those have a lot of details and situations where it's not that clear cut. Again, not our discussion tonight, but in general, a person transgresses rather than be killed. What I want from this is the next source. Okay, this is the Shulchan Aruch's ruling. However, the Rima, Rabbi Moshe Israelis, in his gloss on this comment of Rabbi Yosef Cairo of the Shulchan Aruch, he says, if he can save himself with all that he possesses, he must give everything and not transgress a negative commandment. Okay, and this is an important addendum. And that is that while a person is not obligated to give up one's life for most mitzvos in the Torah, however, money is a different story. A person is obligated to part with even all of his money, all of his possessions, rather than transgress a negative commandment in the Torah. Where this comes up most, I guess one might say poignantly, is in the laws of Lashon Hara. Very fascinatingly, the Chafetz Chaim, the great Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, when he talks about the laws of Lashon Hara, he makes this point and says, let's say you are an employee and your employer comes over and asks you to share some negative information about another employee, and you think this through and you realize that this is Lashon Hara. In other words, there is you don't have halachic reason to share this negative information. Sometimes it is permitted. Let's say another employee is embezzling money. It may well be permitted and even obligatory to share that information. But let's just say your employer comes over to you and wants to know the latest gossip about the guy in the cubicle next to you, and it has no impact on his job. And this employer is, if you don't share this information, he may well decide to relieve you of your job. Are you allowed to share that gossip? The answer, says the Chofetz Chaim, is no, but I'm not going to have a job. How am I going to make a living? Says the Chofetz Chaim, a person is obligated to give up his livelihood and even all of his money rather than transgress a negative commandment. And so it needs to be clear that even though we're talking about one is allowed to transgress, to desecrate Shabbos to save a life, one may not desecrate Shabbos in order to save one's job. Now, that said, a lot of professions which do involve sometimes having to go into work on Shabbos, there are, we'll call, ways to be able to still observe Shabbos and hold on to the job and do what has to be done. Just as an example, famously, Joe Lieberman, Senator Joseph Lieberman, when he was running for vice president, and there was a lot of attention given to his Shabbos observance, and they would talk about how he would walk quite a distance sometimes on Saturdays or Friday nights, either to or from the Capitol, rather than go in a car or things like that. So, you know, standing there listening to someone do a filibuster or having to vote, yes or no, is not a Shabbos transgression per se. So it's a complicated law. But what I want from this is just the overall idea over here is that if a job is at stake, you cannot just go ahead and say, well, I need to make a living, and therefore I can desecrate Shabbos. That is not the case. Okay. So what we're talking about over here, the question in terms of law enforcement, and as we'll see, doctors and so on, is in the context of where a life is actually at stake, not just a livelihood or a job. That brings us to source number four. Okay. And source number four, at first glance, is going to sound very strange. So give me a moment for me to explain it. When Shabbos is desecrated for an ill person who is in danger, we endeavor not to do so through non-Jews, children, or women, but through adult male Jews of sound mind. What does this mean? Right? This sounds very not 2021 type kind of jargon over here. So what does this mean? What it means is as follows. The commentators explain as follows. What it means is like this. Because what we have here are different groups of people who have more limited obligations when it comes to mitzvah observance. For example, non-Jews don't observe Shabbos at all. Children don't have the nearly the same level of obligation. They're only obligated because they are supposed to train themselves in or be trained, but they don't have the full obligation. Women don't have all of the mitzvos that men do. There are a number of mitzvos that women are exempt from. And therefore, the idea is as follows. If a life is in danger and we were to turn around and look for these kinds of people, so mistakes could arise in two ways. One, an observer could say, well, a full-fledged adult Jewish male should not be desecrating Shabbos to save a life. You have to find someone who is less obligated in the mitzvos, like a non-Jew or a child or so on. We don't want that impression to come across. We don't want that the next time something happens and a life is at stake, someone says, well, find the kid under bar mitzvah age. We don't want that happening. So we make it clear that if in the room at the moment where Shabbos desecration needs to take place in order to save a life, that you take someone who is fully obligated in the mitzvos and have that person desecrate the Shabbos to make it clear that everyone is obligated to desecrate Shabbos in order to save a life. Okay, and again, just to show how far that idea goes. However, going to source number five, some say that if it's possible to do it without pushing it off and without delay in an unusual fashion, it should be done in an unusual fashion. And if it can be done through a non-Jew without any delay whatsoever, it should be done through a non-Jew. And here, once again, the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Israelis, and his glosses on the Shulchan Aruch, is making the point as follows. When we talk about the need to desecrate Shabbos, you have to take it into account. Is this an emergency right now, this second, or can it wait a few minutes? Okay, there's a difference between someone who is, God forbid, having a heart attack or a stroke or choking, where every moment counts, versus a situation where, let's just say, a child has a high fever. Okay, so you want to take a young child with a high fever is dangerous, but if it waits another 2 minutes, more often than not, that is not going to make a major difference in terms of the health. Again, if it's a super high fever where there's right now danger and it's an emergency, that's a different story. But sometimes you have a situation where the kid's running a high fever, there's concern for an infection. It could be life-threatening, but it's not urgent this second. So there, says the Rama, if it's not a super emergency, so then either the desecration of Shabbos should be done in an unusual fashion, if you can get the job done that way. I'll just give an example. Classic case, you have to call an ambulance on Shabbos. So using a phone, cell phone, good old-fashioned landlines, remember those? Things like that. Let's say you need to turn on a light in a room. So instead of going ahead and using your finger and pushing the button, you can use your knuckle, okay, of your, if you're a righty, of your left hand or something like that to make it somewhat unusual. So it's a more unusual way of doing it. Again, if this will impede your ability to get the job done in a timely fashion, then drop it. But this is the point he makes. If it's possible to do it without pushing it off and without delay, you could do it in do the melacha, the forbidden area of work of labor on Shabbos in an unusual fashion, it should be done. And if there's time to get a non-Jew who is not obligated to observe Shabbos to do it, normally you can't just go over and ask a non-Jew to perform work on Shabbos. There are situations it's permitted, but certainly in this case where life is in danger, there's time enough to go get a non-Jew, then that should be done. Just to give another example, very, very common example is, let's just say a woman goes into labor on Shabbos. She has to get to a hospital. So usually there is some time between the onset of labor until the expectant mother actually has to go to the hospital. So what will usually happen is instead of the husband driving his wife to the hospital, what will usually happen is they will call a car service or today an Uber and make sure, I guess you have to figure out, or you can assume if you don't ask too many questions, that is a non-Jew driving. And there's enough time to have the non-Jew drive to the hospital. In fact, in large Jewish communities, like on the East Coast in the New York and New Jersey area, a lot of communities actually have a service where before Shabbat begins, once a woman is in her ninth month, where she knows, you know, any day, any minute she can go into labor, there's a service where before Shabbos begins, you can actually like sign up for a service where you just punch in, you know, you just punch in one number and they are ready. The drivers already know all the rules, what they have to do and what they have to do for the mother and so on and so forth to minimize all those awkward conversations of, I can't carry this. Can you carry it for me? The money's over there on the counter and so on. No, before Shabbos starts, you know, you arrange it and the money's taken care of afterwards. So these are things which, again, if there's time, should be done that way to minimize the Shabbos desecration, which brings us to source number 6. And after source number 6, I'll come up for air and take any questions. And that is a very interesting question. Shabbos is dechuya, I will explain in a minute, in the face of danger to life. What does this mean? Pushed away. Here is the question. And this is a question which comes up in a number of different areas where a mitzvah is kind of pushed out of the way for another more important cause. There are two terms here we have to know. Dechuya is a Hebrew word that means pushed away. The other term is hutra, which means permitted. And the question is, when life is in danger and Shabbos desecration now is an obligation to save a life, does that mean that there's no more Shabbos? In other words, Shabbos is just gone because the danger to life just dissolves Shabbos, which means I can basically do whatever I need, whatever I want, because there's anything in the context of saving the life. I can do anything and not worry about what I'm doing whatsoever in order to save a life because Shabbos has just disappeared in the face of this danger to life? Or do we say it's pushed away, meaning it's still Shabbos. I still have to observe Shabbos. I still have to observe the laws, but I can do what I need to do at bare minimum, even though it involves desecrating Shabbos. I could desecrate the bare minimum in order to save a life. What's the difference? Well, a difference would be source number 5. If we say that Shabbos is gone in the face of a danger to life, well, then why can't I just dial the phone normally? Why can't I drive my wife to the hospital if she's in labor on Shabbos? There's no more Shabbos as far as saving this life right now goes. So who cares if I do it in an unusual fashion? Why can't I do it myself instead of asking a non-Jew to do it? Shabbos is hutra. It's permitted. It's just not here anymore. And so this source number 6 kind of gives a framework and tells us, no, it's not a free-for-all. Yes, as we saw, you need to do whatever you need to do to make sure that a life is not endangered. And as we saw in the earlier sources, in source number two, delaying may be akin to murder, God forbid, if one is too, if someone wants to be too, let's just say, conservative in this case, and say, I don't know if really the life was endangered, do we have to do it? And you're making, and the person is making a serious mistake, and might be akin to murder, then you do what you have to do. But it's not a free-for-all. And so if the person has the time and the presence of mind to think this through, what's the real danger? Do I have time to do it in an unusual fashion? Do I have time to ask a non-Jew to do it instead, and so on? So then that is something which is obligatory, okay, as far as that goes. So that, I think, is the backdrop for our conversation, in which I think, again, obviously would can be applied easily to when you have an agent in law enforcement whose expertise is needed, let's say, for analysis on a case, or as how I mentioned, sometimes if you end up in a situation where you have a hostage crisis, okay, and you have to get onto the scene, or you have to pick up the telephone and talk on the telephone and so on. Okay, I'm picking up the telephone. So can I, you know, do I just talk straight into the speaker? Do I push the buttons in the normal fashion? Again, it would depend on the situation. If worrying about pushing the buttons with your knuckles or so on and so forth is going to distract you and impinge on your ability to be clear, present mind, and use all of your faculties to negotiate with the criminals, so then go ahead and push it normally. If you're too busy being distracted about how to push the buttons properly to be able to focus on the life-saving work at hand, so then scratch it and just push the buttons normally. But if you're already able to do that, let's just say you've practiced it, or you're able to just do it with your knuckles or your left hand and not impinge and not affect your ability to do what you need to save lives, so then obviously that would be ideal. Driving a car, okay? Is it a good idea to drive a car in an unusual fashion? Probably not, especially not if your wife is in labor in the car. You know, that's not the ideal time to start with that. But again, each situation is its own. I actually once saw a whole write-up about this question where a rabbi was writing saying, you know, maybe the driver is going to think, I won't turn on the headlight because turning on a light on Shabbos is a problem. And so the rabbi said, well, that's very nice, but there's a reason you have headlights on your car. And that is because if you don't have headlights, it's at night, people aren't going to see you. And you might not be able to see the road. So you are putting lives at danger. Turn on the headlights. So, you know, each case needs its own decision to figure out. So if there are questions at this point, I will, like I said, come up for air. And if there are any questions for myself or for Howie, or Howie, if you have any comments or on what I've discussed, now's everyone's big chance.
I've got a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I was wondering why a woman going into labor is counted as saving a life, because for centuries and centuries, women did not go to the hospital when they went into labor. Not that I'm advocating, I'm just curious.
Right. So the answer to that question, that's a fair question. I think the answer is that modern medicine, again, I know there are alternative opinions out there about, you know, women who do go through modern day midwives and so on. But generally speaking, in most cases, the safest way to have a baby is in a hospital with the proper medical personnel and equipment and so on. If a woman decided and prepped beforehand and is going to have a midwife in the home, okay, that's her decision, and she feels that's a safe way to go. But to decide when labor begins to have a medic come in and deliver the baby or so on, that is not the safest way to go. Maybe statistically it's a very slim chance of danger to life, but certainly it does create a greater danger both to the mother and to the child. So because common medical wisdom, standard medical wisdom will say the safest way to have a baby is in the hospital, therefore that is considered a danger to life if she would stay at home and, let's say, wait for a medic or a doctor to come to her home. All right. Again, to be clear, if the woman set up beforehand a system whereby she's going to have the baby at home, then that is probably safe for her. But generally, that's not the case.
So, Rabbi and Howie, I think the question for many of us is, what is the relative risk involved that you have to evaluate each time something like this might come up? For example, there may be somebody on the phone to a psychologist who's suggesting the person is suicidal. Well, there may be something, but it may not be, but it could be. We're not sure. Will talk do better? Do you have to see the person? Do you, and how we may have situations come up where it looks like it's going to be a significant threat, but maybe it really isn't, and maybe somebody else can handle it. I mean, there's so many nuances to this question about what consists and is considered a significant threat to life that one has to desecrate Shabbos. I would think that would come up so frequently, and many people will have a walk around to be able to circumvent some of the restrictions.
How would you want to weigh in on
sure.
that?
Yeah. So the best example I have was from my time on the counterterrorism squad. So we had probably, like I said, roughly a year where there was a situation where, and if I'm hesitating, it's only because here's the thing. I can't even ask a Shiloh, right? Because let's say I call up a rabbi on Fridays and I say, you know, I got a situation. I might have to keep my phone on Shabbat. And he says, well, what situation? I'm like, I can't tell you. I can't tell him. I can't discuss the parameters of the investigation. I certainly can't discuss anything classified. So basically I have to figure out on my own, you know, what are the relative risks and weigh that. And so one thing that I definitely consider is what I'm doing derabanan or is it deraita, right? So keeping a phone on me, arguably derabanan. Certainly if I'm not using it. My workaround with my supervisor was, look, if something happens, you call me and I'm going to answer the phone if you call, but not if anyone else calls, right? So you call me, and if I need to come in, just we'll talk at that point, but don't have anyone else call me. You call me. Cause I don't know if I'll recognize her number or his number when it comes up on the screen, but I'm not going to necessarily recognize another number. I can't tell you how many stupid calls I get on my bureau cell phone. Everything from, I'm under investigation by the FBI, which I think is hilarious. I can't tell you how many times I'm like, hey guys, anybody here investigating me? Nope. Great. My social security number has been revoked. It's my car, you know, my car's out of warranty. I get those all the time. I get stuff in Chinese. I mean, you name it. That phone rings all the time. So it's a bunch of nonsense. That's why I tell my supervisor, just you call me and I'll answer the phone that way. You know, if it was anything beyond that, you know, then I have to really evaluate, like, okay, well, what are we talking about here? You know, driving a car on Shabbat is a deraita, it's not a derabanan. So that's another factor I think comes into play.
Right. And in theory, one, if you had the time, again, going back to the question of a delay, let's just say you're close enough and you could take a bicycle or take an Uber or a cab or something like that, where asking a non-Jew to drive you is only, as you said, a derabanan, a rabbinic issue, as opposed to a full-fledged Torah desecration.
Yeah, I would assume, though, if my supervisor calls me, there's something going on. I am getting in the closest car I can and going at a high rate of speed. I've had to do that to the office. I've gotten there in 9 minutes. I live 15 minutes away.
Is it permitted to ride a bicycle on Shabbos?
So generally, you're not supposed to for various reasons. Certainly, if there's no Erev, you can't take the bicycle, you know, but it would be less of an issue than driving a car. That's all. I'm not getting involved in all the technical details right now. Maybe we'll do a future class on riding bicycles on Shabbos. It certainly might create a vicious cycle. I'm sorry. Danny's rolling his eyes at me. Okay, so it's Danny Woodrow. There's too many Dannys here on the thing. Okay, so all right, Howie, if you have anything else to add. Okay, so if I can just you know, talk to that question as well, and we'll see more sources in a moment on this very question of that Dr. Barenberg is bringing up. How do you ascertain? Sometimes it's really not simple. Going back to medical cases, I once witnessed an individual in shul one Shabbos morning in middle of the davening, middle of the services, and he was about to swat a bug that was flying around, and I said, you know how to kill bugs, you know, insects on Shabbos, you know, just, you know. So he said, it's a mosquito. I said, it's not, but let's say it is. He said, it might have West Nile virus. And it could bite me and give me West Nile virus. I said, how many cases of West Nile virus are you aware of have happened in Colorado, you know, over the last number of years? And how many mosquitoes have you killed recently to make sure that you never get it? You know, to me, first of all, he was wrong. It wasn't a mosquito. But even if it was a mosquito, that is, as we'll see soon, that is a very remote concern. Okay. Now, if there's a little COVID bearing fly flying around or a malaria bearing mosquito, that might be a different story. Okay. The Talmud makes very clear. If a venomous snake or a scorpion is scuttling around or crawling around and it may bite someone, so then, you know, you trap it or kill it on Shabbos because that's clear and present danger. But there's a lot of room between a mosquito that might have West Nile virus and a venomous snake. There's no shortage. What about a bee flying around? Well, if someone is allergic, that's clear and present danger. If no one is allergic, okay, someone might get a sting. Is that grounds enough? You know, so these kinds of questions, where do you draw the line in terms of that, are not always that clear. And again, when you're not sure, as Howie pointed out, if he gets that phone call, his assumption is something's up. So you don't stop and start trying to figure out, what should I do? You get in the car and you drive 100 miles an hour to your office, because there's a possibility that a life is in danger. And once we have that possibility, so then we go back to source number two, and that is the one who acts with alacrity is praised, the one who is asked is disgraceful, one who asks is a murderer. Okay. If there's a real possibility that lives are in danger, so act first and ask questions later in terms of Shabbos desecration. Okay. And I think that is a general rule that should be used both in the medical world and in the case of law enforcement. Okay. Now let's indeed move along over here as to some of the issues which Dr. Bamberg raised, source number seven. Okay. Which will shed some light on some of these questions. Someone else could do it. Well, how do you define that if someone else could do it? What if I'm a bigger expert? What if I'm more familiar with the case? What if I already dealt with these people in negotiations and now I need to come back so they're comfortable with me as the negotiator? So source number seven says, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and such would be the law if there is concern for danger to, I'm sorry, I skipped one. Before I get to that question, I do have to focus on source number seven here, which is a different question. I apologize. Such would be the law if there is concern for danger to life tomorrow. And it's unknown, I'm missing an apostrophe there, sorry. It is unknown if there will be a possibility to save unless they perform the forbidden labor today. And today is Shabbos. It will be permitted to do it on Shabbos, even though there is not yet danger, since according to the way of nature and what is assumed, tomorrow there will be danger, and it is unclear if they will be able to save him. That's a very wordy way of saying, and again, I'm just translating from the Hebrew, so the Hebrew gets wordy when translated into the English. And I apologize as always for that. But what Rabbi Feinstein is saying is as follows. Very often in the world of medicine or in the world of law enforcement, certainly, like in the case where you have counterterrorism, no one is, God forbid, blowing anything up today. But you need to assess today to save a life tomorrow or next week. And any delay could result in the loss of life in a day, in a week, in a month. So in the case where waiting till afterwards will put a life in danger later. Right now, the danger is not here yet. But if you don't act today on Shabbos, that could well create danger based, as he says, according to the way of nature and what is assumed. Tomorrow, there will be danger. So then he says, of course, you are allowed to and obligated to desecrate Shabbos in order to prevent that from occurring. So again, assessment, assessment, assessment. You have to try to figure out on the spot, do I need to act now in order to save a life tomorrow or next week or so on? This happens going back to in the world of medicine to a woman who's in labor. Can she wait till after Shabbos to go to the hospital, or does she have to go now? Well, right now the contractions are pretty far apart and she's still early on in labor. Do I need to go now? Can it wait? Or if I wait too long, I might end up in trouble. Again, assessment, assess, what do the husband and wife assess? What would the rabbi assess? Well, what's her history? How fast does she usually go through a labor? Does she usually take a long time? How fast can she get to the hospital? Et cetera, et cetera. These are factors in the world of law enforcement. There's no immediate threat, But if we wait another day or a few more hours till after Shabbos is over, what is that going to do for our ability to mitigate, to minimize the threat later on? That has to be assessed. And that, I think, is what he's focusing on over here in this source, is that how much can you afford to delay dealing with it and make sure that lives are not placed in danger? Okay. Source number 8. Now we get to this question. It is obvious that if there's an ill person who is definitely in danger and he wants specifically this doctor. Okay. So you have a Jewish doctor who gets a call on Shabbat, on Shabbos, that a patient is asking for you. He wants you to treat him. He's comfortable with you. He's not comfortable with the other doctors. He is allowed to travel there and desecrate Shabbos. We're talking about a patient whose life is in danger. In whatever way is necessary to hurry his arrival there. Okay. I want to just, as a interesting tangential point, is a husband allowed to go with the wife in the taxi on Shabbos to the hospital? By the way, I'm giving all these examples because this is what came up most common in my life in terms of these kinds of questions. So is the husband allowed to go with the wife in the taxi cab to the hospital? And the answer is yes. Why? Because if she's left on her own to go in the ambulance or in a taxi cab or whatever, she's going to feel very isolated, very alone, not taken care of. She needs her husband there to for that assurance that she's in good hands, that her husband is there to take care of him. And therefore, the husband is allowed and probably obligated to go in that car on Shabbos with his wife so that she is comfortable, she feels reassured. And here's the same thing. If a patient whose life is in danger wants specifically a certain doctor and will be comfortable and therefore is a better chance for his survival, then says Rabbi Feinstein, he goes, but if the doctor knows already from Erev Shabbos, from before Shabbos, he already knew that this patient wants him, the doctor is obligated to remain and spend the night in a nearby house near the hospital. In other words, if the doctor knows he's going to be needed on Shabbos itself, he knows he's going to have to go in there. He's not allowed to just go home and spend the night at home and the next morning get in his car and drive there or get in a taxi cab. If he knows he's going to be needed to save a life, he's obligated to stay in a hotel or in a home nearby so that he doesn't have to desecrate Shabbos. And even if he has to pay a rental fee to spend the night, he's not permitted to go to his home, which will lead him to desecrate the Shabbos tomorrow when he needs to travel to the hospital. So Rabbi Feinstein here makes the point that even though this doctor is needed and he's allowed to desecrate Shabbos to go, if he is the doctor who is called and he is a doctor who is needed, and because he's the one being called, he is allowed to desecrate Shabbos. If he knew beforehand, he has to make appropriate preparations. He does make the point that the doctor is not obligated to spend the night in the street. Okay, that he's not obligated to do. But he should find, you know, if he has to pay some money for a hotel room or stay in someone's home nearby, that he is obligated to do. So again, the idea of planning ahead, of awareness and so on and so forth is integral in this conversation. If before Shabbos started, a law enforcement person knows there's already something up and going on, and he, you know, to go home and just have a regular, you know, I'll go home and I'll spend the night at home, and then tomorrow I'll go into work, and tomorrow life is in danger. That's not appropriate. That's not appropriate because he already knows he's going to have to go there. So he should make arrangements to be in the vicinity of where he needs to be, if it's possible, so that he doesn't have to desecrate the Shabbos later on. Rabbi Feinstein, in the same response, continues, and he says, if there's another doctor and the ill person is not particular which doctor treats him, it is certainly forbidden for him to desecrate Shabbos, for there is no known reason that he is better. And this is a key line. There is no known reason that he is better. This is a very important line, which Howie made before. And that is, which Dr. Barenbrink brought up. That is, why can't someone else do it? Well, sometimes someone else could. But sometimes, even though someone else could do it, maybe you are the better person to do it. Like you said, you're already involved in those negotiations. You already have a lot of information. And so you are better informed. You are more skilled in this particular area. If that's the case, and because of your greater skill or information or whatever it may be, there is a better chance that a life will be saved, then yes, you go ahead and you desecrate Shabbos to go down there. Okay, so these are a few sources, which again, Dr. Barenbrink, as I said, we can't address every case, but give some parameters and framework for the questions at hand over here. It all boils down to 2 points. Number one, when possible, mitigate the desecration of Shabbos. make preparations ahead of time, stay nearby if you know it's going to happen, try to do things in unusual fashion, but at the same time, assess, what do I need to do? Am I needed? Do I have a greater expertise? Will me being there and desecrating Shabbos mean that there's a better chance that lives will be saved and less danger to life? So then that is the second point that we have to focus on.
Question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what if the doctor finds himself, he can find a room, but he can't do Shabbos observance? Maybe he can't even find kosher food.
Again, you mean in the case where he's finding a hotel room or something like that?
Yeah.
So again, if you could just say the question again, if he is...
You said that he's obligated to be nearby, but what if he can be nearby in a room, but he doesn't have the challah, he doesn't have the wine, maybe he doesn't even have kosher food.
Right. So in that case, you know, sometimes there are mitigating factors which can affect what his obligation is. And, you know, if he is able, he knows in advance the halachic authority should be consulted. Usually the lack of let's say proper Shabbos food, the fact that he'll have to eat crackers and tuna over Shabbos instead of chalent and kugel and so on is not going to be grounds to allow him to desecrate Shabbos. Okay. On the other hand, if you won't have any food at all, so he'll be, let's say, fasting, for sure, if that will, you know, impinge his ability to function as a doctor properly or things like that, that may well allow him to stay home and be able to eat properly. But I think more often than not, you can usually find some form of kosher food that'll keep you afloat for Shabbos, even if it's not, you know, your standard Shabbos fare.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Well, what about the issue of carrying a gun to shul? If that's part of your job description.
Right. Okay. So I mean, really carrying a gun to shul is a whole different discussion. But I know there are, you know, many shuls in Denver where there are people who have a concealed weapon and so on. Certainly within the Erev, there's not that much of an issue. Certainly, like you said, if that's part of your job description. So the biggest issue you are dealing with over there is mukta, meaning items that are supposed to be off limits. For sure, if it's part of your job description, you need to have that weapon with you. It's permitted. I'm sorry, I mixed up two things. I thought you were talking about someone who has it there for general security. If a person's a law enforcement officer and he needs to have his gun on him for his job, and at any minute he could be, let's say, called out, he needs to have that weapon. So then I would say that is, part and parcel of being able to preserve lives. That wouldn't just be true for law enforcement. If you have, again, like I said, in a lot of synagogues across the country, people have weapons on their person in shul in case, God forbid, something happens. And unfortunately, we have seen incidents, happen. So they would be allowed to carry it. Whether they would be allowed to carry it where there's no Erev on Shabbos, so that would depend on the degree of danger and the need and so on. So then a rabbi, halachic authority, should be consulted as to what the best approach is. If you ever have the opportunity to go to, again, large Jewish communities where they have what they call hatzalah. Okay, those who are not familiar, Hatzalah is a volunteer ambulance service. And in many, many communities, I'm not here to bash government-run ambulance services or whatever, but generally Hatzalah is well-known to be very, very quick and efficient, and they usually work hand-in-hand with other medical personnel and so on. You will see many people in shul on Shabbos with a walkie-talkie on their belt, and they will be regularly leaning over to hear what's coming out of their walkie-talkie because they leave it on low. And sometimes you'll see them fiddling with the volume if they have to hear, if they're getting a call or things like that. Now, normally a walkie-talkie is not something you carry around with you on Shabbos, right? But in this case, they're allowed to because they are on call. And if, God forbid, they are needed, so then they might dash out of shul in middle of, you know, of the services of davening to go save a life. So I think a gun falls into a weapon may well fall into a similar category where that weapon is there to potentially protect life. But again, each scenario needs its own assessment because of the different factors. Does this individual really need to have that weapon, or is he just doing it because he wants to be macho and feel good about himself that he is protecting everyone? I'm not here to politicize anything. I'm just, sometimes it's real, sometimes it's a macho thing. Is there a real risk? Is there a real risk, or is it just, you know, maybe just in case? How many people need to have a weapon in shul? Does, you know, do 50% of the congregants need to have weapons, or is it enough to have two or three, you know, and so on and so forth? So I'm not getting, and I'm sure Howie can, looks like he has what to say about that, about that matter, more than I do. So I'll keep my mouth shut on that. And maybe if you want to weigh in on that question of the need for people to have weapons, all I know is that someone told me that, a law enforcement professional once commented on, I guess, you know, self-appointed vigilantes who bring weapons to shul, that God forbid they should pull them out because the crossfire between the different congregants, you know, might cause more harm than any God forbid intruder who walks in there.
I was just going to say the training that goes along with the weapon is, yeah, if they do that, great. If not, they should not be armed.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, like, so yes, you know, so getting back to Danny Woodrow's point, certainly there are situations where a gun is warranted and permitted, and there are certainly certain situations where it's not. Okay. Just to get to the last source here, and I may even finish on time. I don't want to set a precedent for myself here, but source number 10, very, very interesting source over here. Let me give the background on this. The Nodeb Yehuda was one of the preeminent 18th century halachic authorities. His name was Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. He was the chief rabbi of Prague in Czechoslovakia in the 1700s. And he was asked the following question. Autopsies are generally forbidden according to Jewish law on a dead body. We don't mess around with the body. And he was asked if it's permitted for medical personnel, students, to perform autopsies on dead bodies for the purpose of research so that they can get more medical information, which down the line would allow them to have more insight into how the human body works, which could ultimately lead to lives being saved. Okay. And he was asked, is that a valid reason to allow autopsies because you're saving lives? And he has a lengthy response, and I'm just quoting, it is a pretty lengthy source, but he says the following. He says, all this is where there is possible danger to life in front of us, such as an ill person or a collapsed building. Howie, that's where you saw the issue of the collapsed building. Okay. In other words, if a building collapses, and the Talmud says that even if there's a remote possibility that someone's alive in there, you are allowed to, even on Shabbos, you know, clear out the building, even if it involves doing all sorts of forbidden areas of labor and so on. If there's a remote possibility that someone's alive, you are allowed and obligated to desecrate Shabbos. But in our discussion, they only want to learn this area of knowledge, and perhaps they will come across an ill person who requires this. For this, we certainly do not push away a Torah prohibition or even a rabbinic prohibition. For if you call this concern possible danger to life, if so, all areas of medicine, such as grinding and cooking herbs, preparing the instruments for surgery, etc., would be permitted on Shabbos, for perhaps you will come across an ill person today or the following night. I'm missing a T once again. Or the following night. And it is difficult to distinguish between a time that is close by to a time that is distant. This last sentence is a little bit, again, just translated from the Hebrew. But what he's saying is like this. There's a big difference between clear and present danger and a very distant, remote possibility of saving lives. So while, of course, if a person is ill right in front of us, or a building collapses, God forbid, and there are people trapped inside, of course you desecrate Shabbos to save those people. But if you're talking about performing autopsies, which is generally forbidden according to Torah law, okay, because you'll find out medical knowledge, which will give you greater insight, which will down the line enable you to save lives. That is what he calls a time that is distant. That's not clear and present danger. You can't transgress mitzvahs of the Torah for that purpose. Okay. Because he says, if that's the case, I should be allowed to grind herbs to make medicine. Now you cannot grind food on Shabbos or herbs on Shabbos to make medicine unless a person needs the medicine right now to save his life. But you can't say, well, what if a person shows up at my door and they happen to need this medicine and therefore I can make it? What if a person shows up and needs surgery right now? So I better get my instruments ready and sharpen them and get them ready. If that is a very distant possibility, a remote possibility, going back to my mosquito example, that does not warrant desecrating Shabbos. If we can apply that to the case of law enforcement, how we discussed with me cases where, let's say you have information about drugs that are being brought in, or maybe I miss, or something to that effect. Okay. Where the fact that there are drugs in a house and the FBI wants to, you know, raid the house or analyze intelligence on this to figure out and so on. Well, drugs certainly do bring about deaths. There's no question about it. But is that a clear and present danger, or is that further down the road? Very often that is not a immediate danger. It's, well, once those drugs hit the streets, well, then people will likely, there will likely be people who will overdose and it will cost them their lives. Or it will create gang wars or drug wars, and people will be killed and things like that. Is that a reason to desecrate Shabbos now to stop those drugs from being made available? Because down the line, other things will happen. I'd be much more skeptical. Again, I'm not giving a final ruling, and every case needs its own assessment, but I'd be much more skeptical in a case like that to say, sure, you can desecrate Shabbos in order to stop those drugs from hitting the street, as opposed to where there's a real terrorist threat, okay? And an analysis is needed right now to understand what's happening to prevent a potential terrorist attack or something like that, where delay can mean a terrorist attack is going to happen in the coming days or weeks or so on. That may be a real clear danger right now, because someone is planning a terrorist attack that is clear and present danger. It won't happen for a month. Well, that brings us back to source number 7, Rabbi Feinstein. If the danger will occur tomorrow, but you don't know if it'll be too late if you wait till tomorrow, so then you can assess it. But when you're talking about drugs hitting the streets, there's a lot of steps from the drugs being made available to a life loss. I'd be more skeptical that that is grounds to, again, I'm not saying for sure, it would depend on the situation, but I think it would be much harder to say over there that clearly Shabbos should be desecrated. So this is just, again, another source of how far do you go in terms of law enforcement of when you can or cannot desecrate Shabbos for intelligence analysis or for, you know, dealing with these kinds of situations. It, again, it's not every situation is unique, but the basic framework is we have to assess what is the level of danger right now in front of us. Okay, so that's my piece as far as some of the questions and issues that will be dealt with. And if there are any, Howie, if you have any final insights or comments, or anyone who has any questions, now's your big chance.
So Rabbi, you've basically been talking about the danger for the loss of life.
Right.
I'm wondering about the loss of limb. For That's example, all. A severe okay. injury, a severe ocular injury, a severe infection, a severe, because many of us will think that it should be in terms of the health of somebody. Rather, you've been emphasizing the loss of life, not as the possible danger from the loss of function of a part of a body. Does that qualify as a way to desecrate the Shabbos also?
Right. So that's a very good question. And the answer is quite complex. If I could give a basic framework, a basic, vague answer, which is what I'm good at doing. So, the basic parameters are thus. If the danger to limb, let's say an infection, potentially could become life threatening, which, you know, often infections can become. So then that will be categorized as a life-threatening issue. If the loss of limb is merely a loss of limb, but it's not a danger to life, so then certain areas of Shabbos desecration are permitted. Generally, rabbinic, there's a lot more leniency for rabbinic areas of desecration, a lot more leniency. But for Torah level, those are more problematic, even for loss of limb, okay? But because very often many areas of rabbinic restrictions are waived, if a limb is in danger, again, not all, again, it depends on the situation and what exactly needs to be done, it's generally possible to deal with the potential loss of limb through rabbinic methods without having to actually desecrate a full Torah level Shabbos area of labor. Okay, that is, like I said, that is the vague answer.
Very vague.
Okay, yeah, it's like I said, it's a complex area of halacha. In addition to that, the Talmud talks about certain types of infections, which the Talmud defines as being life threatening, which modern medicine may not agree with, but the Talmud says it, and we accept the sage's assessment, of what is life threatening, even if modern medicine doesn't agree with it. Conversely, the fact that the Talmud doesn't discuss a particular infection or condition as life-threatening, but modern medicine says, well, it is, that may well be grounds for us to desecrate Shabbos as well. So, you know, that's in terms of medical issues. Okay? So if there are no further comments or questions, I will thank you again to Howie Shapiro.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And by the way, just to point out, my understanding is that the name Shapiro/Shapiro comes from the famous German-French city of Spire. So therefore I would think, and the name Spiro, Spira, comes from there as well. So that being the case, the long I is probably more accurate, regardless, than the short I. So I wish, again, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. And God willing, we will have another class in January. So stay tuned for information on that. Wish everyone a wonderful evening and have a great Shabbos.